From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Tropical Storm Irma is making its way north today. The storm has been battering Florida since yesterday, delivering record wind and storm surge in some areas. 6 million people are without power. Irma made its first U.S. landfall in the Keys and its second in Marco Island, just south of Naples, as a Category 3 hurricane with 130-mile-per-hour winds. Marco is a place I know well. I got married there and have visited for years. And joining us now is Larry Honig, chairman of the Marco Island City Council. Welcome.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
And what's the situation there at this point? Do you have a sense of the damage?
Yes, I've been driving around the island all morning since first light with our first responders. The damage is what you would expect from a Category 3 or 4 hitting land. There's mostly tree debris on the roads, lots of palm fronds covering the roads. The water has completely receded. Last night, approximately a third of the island was covered in at least a foot or two of water from the surge. It has all receded. All of the roads are passable. Now, we don't have water, and we don't have electricity.
And you say just a couple of feet of water, because the expectation was that the surge was going to be 10 to 15 feet, right?
That is correct. Now, again, the survey is not complete. There may have been isolated cases where the surge was greater and more than the 3 or 4 feet I'm quoting you. As I say, the south end of the island was inundated, so at some point there may have been a surge greater than the 3 or 4 feet. But 10 feet seems unlikely, except perhaps on, since you know Marco Island, on the beach, it could be that that surge on those condominiums and hotels on the beach could have been that high, reaching their pool level or even their first floor level. I don't know that.
What about structural damage to buildings? Are you seeing much of that?
We're not seeing much of that. There are roof tiles missing from many houses. That's a normal occurrence in a windstorm like this. But I've seen no major structural damage of any kind. Many of the buildings boarded themselves up with plywood, et cetera. They appear intact. All the buildings on the beach appear intact. So we've seen remarkably little, if any, structural damage. And no human damage that we know of so far.
Well, that's a very good thing. How many people stayed on the island?
Jeremy, we believe that about 1,000 people stayed. At this time of the year, we would have 16 or 17,000 residents in August and September. We asked people voluntarily last Tuesday to leave the island. We issued a mandatory evacuation order on Thursday. We asked the people who remained to give us their address so that we could check on them post-event. And last night we had to do a number of water rescues from our personal watercraft of people who had given their addresses as homes that turned out to be flooded into the first level.
Now, you stayed. What was that experience like? Because there's actually been very little video out of Marco Island of what it was like when that storm made landfall there.
And I think part of that, Jeremy, is because it was during the dark hours mostly. And I live in a Category 5 rated house, but it was noisy and nasty. And I've certainly never been through anything like it, and it lasts longer than you want it to last. And then comes back after the eye goes over, and the eye went right over Marco.
Right.
After the eye goes over, you get the back end when it comes a little less intense, but it brings the storm surge with it. You could actually see the water rising. It rose in a very fast manner, probably took an hour.
At this point, you say you've been driving around the island. Can you make it through the streets? Are there trees down and power lines down that get in the way?
There are essentially no power lines down. We have had, we've shut the power off voluntarily because there was the likelihood of infrastructure damage to our water sewer treatment plant, so we'll evaluate that. There are trees and palm fronds littering the streets, but there's no street that is totally impassable.
And you say you don't have power and you don't have water right now. Do you have a sense of when that'll come back?
We are hoping to get the power back today. Hey, I'm an optimist, but the Florida Power and Light people stayed in a secure facility that we have on island. So they were out and about as soon as they could get out, starting last night. And I think the main issue there is to make sure that our infrastructure won't be compromised. That could occur today to get the power back on. And if the power comes back on, we will almost certainly turn the water back on.
Now, people who have been to Marco Island know that it's got this big, huge beach, and a lot of it is not the natural way that that beach was. It's been added in. What happened to the beach? Do you know?
The beach survived, and I don't think there's major beach damage. I'm not an environmental engineer, but it looks as though that beach is going to be fine. Now, we do have a very robust county administration that worries about the coastal beauty as well as the environment. And that beach will be restored very fast if, in fact, there is any damage.
So what's your biggest concern at this point?
Just rebuilding the community and having it come back to what it was and having people have a sense that Marco Island is a place where you can live and have a family, have a business, and not have to worry all the time about this kind of an event. It's been 2005, that's 12 years since the last hurricane event on Marco Island, and it looks like we're going to get through this one successfully, I hope so. We've got a very strong and vibrant community, as you know, and I think when the snowboarders return to Marco Island, I believe they will find it not as bad as they may have thought it could have been.
Well, it's just a beautiful place. I've spent a lot of time there, and I just wish you all the best in recovering from this storm. It sounds like, at least at this point, it could have been a lot worse. Larry Honig, chairman of the Marco Island City Council. Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day, Jeremy.
It's 9/11. At the Pentagon this morning, the President and First Lady observed the 16th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. President Trump addressing the families of victims.
Though we can never erase your pain or bring back those you lost, we can honor their sacrifice by pledging our resolve to do whatever we must to keep our people safe.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, joins us for a Monday morning look at politics. Your thoughts on the president's message today?
Robin, the president began on the South Lawn of the White House, and there was a remembrance there on the South Lawn. And then the president traveled over to the Pentagon, where he laid a wreath at the 9/11 memorial at the Pentagon. We had those remarks that we just heard. You know, the vice president, Mike Pence, went out to Pennsylvania, to Shanksville, which is where the fourth plane went down, the fourth plane that was coming back to strike Washington. The general supposition has been that plane was aiming at the Capitol, where a young freshman congressman from Indiana named Mike Pence was serving that day. And he observed today, when he stood there at the memorial in Pennsylvania, that the heroes of Flight 93, who, of course, challenged those terrorists and took control of the plane or struggled with them and the plane went down, those people had probably saved his own life.
Yeah. Let's roll, they said. Well, so a somber day once again. But let's turn to the other news that we are covering, which is the storm response. Trump supporter Rush Limbaugh essentially said coverage of Irma was ginned up to sell water bottles. He said it was to hype conspiracy theories about climate change. Then he begrudgingly evacuated. Now, in another administration, you might have heard a president, you know, rebuke someone telling people not to listen to evacuation orders. And we know climate change doesn't create hurricanes, but the evidence points to warming making the storms worse. Is President Trump going to have to answer more questions about his skepticism of climate change after Irma and Harvey?
That seems quite likely. The media have picked this up as a mantra, the climate change issue. And this, I think, probably was why Rush Limbaugh was really upset. It wasn't just that he couldn't get his normal programs on television, but because he could see that this is going to turn the conversation in that direction. John McCain, in an interview yesterday on CNN with Jake Tapper, made reference to the unprecedented things that are happening in the climate and how the country has to come to grips with that, and that the Republican Party needs to come to grips with that much more than it has.
Yeah. I want to mention the Steve Bannon interview last night. Trump's former chief strategist Bannon told CBS's Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes that President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey was the biggest mistake in modern political history.
I don't think there's any doubt that if James Comey had not been fired, we would not have a special counsel. Yes.
So we would not have the Mueller investigation.
Would not have the Mueller investigation in the breadth that clearly Mr. Mueller is going.
So, Ron, do you think that's true? And also, Bannon was asked if Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, was responsible for that firing. He wouldn't say. So what do you make of this?
Well, it's been generally reported that Jared Kushner supported the firing. But as far as whether we would have an investigation, what we would have would be a James Comey investigation or someone else in the FBI probably leading that investigation. And we don't know what scope they would have established or what limitations they might have seen. Instead, simply because there had been this firing, we got a special counsel. That could have happened anyway, but almost surely happened because Comey had been fired. So, yes, there's a Bob Mueller investigation because there isn't a Jim Comey investigation. And, of course, it includes, among other things, the reasoning behind the firing of James Comey. So, yes, that also was created by the firing. With respect to Jared Kushner, we know there's been a long-time rivalry there. We know there's been no love lost between Steve Bannon and some of the members of the Trump family, particularly his son-in-law.
Ron Elving, you mentioned John McCain speaking with CNN's Jake Tapper. I just want to end with a question that Jake asked him and McCain's response. Let's listen.
I hope I don't run this clip for another 50 years, but how do you want the American people to remember you?
He served his country, and not always right. Made a lot of mistakes, made a lot of errors, but served his country, and I hope we could add honorably.
And Ron Elving, there's nothing we can add to that. Just such a graceful moment. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Irma has been downgraded to a tropical storm as it heads north, but all of Florida has been affected, especially coastal communities on both coasts. And there is still danger of a life-threatening storm surge flooding along parts of the Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina coasts. I spoke with Fort Lauderdale Mayor Jack Seiler this morning, shortly after that city's curfew was lifted, and I asked him what the condition of Fort Lauderdale is today.
A lot of downed power lines. First and foremost on that, we're telling people, you know, don't go near them, stay away from them, let the experts handle those. A lot of downed trees. We went out last night. We were just trying to do an assessment, and we found over 100 trees that were blocking portions of streets, roads, and highways in Fort Lauderdale. So, and probably those downed trees cause a lot of the downed power lines because they fall and bring the power line down with them. And then we have probably less than half of our traffic lights functioning. A lot of the street signs are down. And then we're out on the beach here last night and again this morning. A lot of sand came over the wall, and there were three cars stranded last night in the sand on Fort Lauderdale Beach, which can tell you how high the sand is.
Hmm. And how do you start to deal with all of that? Do you have the crews ready to go out and get the trees off the roads and put the power lines back up and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. You know, we've been very fortunate that we had plenty of notice with this storm. And so we spent, you know, 3, 4, 5 days getting ready for the storm. But in that same process, we got ready for the post-storm activities, got ready for how do we deal with the recovery, how do we deal with the cleanup. And so this morning at 5 a.m., we started. We started with the cleanup of A1A, the cleanup of, you know, downtown areas. The biggest problem we have is that, you know, right now the curfew is being lifted at 10 o'clock, and that creates a little bit of an urgency because not that we don't want our neighbors and residents and everybody to get back to normalcy and get back to their homes, and those that evacuated get back and those that stayed home get out. And they might think, well, if the curfew is lifted, it's okay for me to travel around the city. And it's not. We're asking people, unless you have to go somewhere, hang around your house, clean up your yard, you know, clean up your street and your neighborhood. And there's plenty to clean up, trust me. We're in that mode. We're ready. I could not be more proud of the city team. All of our city employees, 2,500 strong, have just been remarkable throughout this whole event.
What percentage of your citizens would you say are back in Fort Lauderdale at this point?
You know, most of the eastern portion of Fort Lauderdale, the Barrier Island, most of that area was evacuated. Most of the people in the central and the western portion just kind of, to use the term, hunkered down, rode right. The storm out, you know, fixed up their houses and made sure they were solidified and fortified. And so I would say we probably have 3/4 of the population here in town, but I think there's a vast number of evacuees from the east side that have not yet returned, and that'll start around 10 a.m. this morning.
And are you worried about looting at this point?
That was a very big concern, and we actually have already made over, I think we're up to 11 or 12 arrests for looting, and we're going to continue to arrest for looting. There's nothing that bothers me more than people that take advantage of those that have been disadvantaged, and we've made it very clear that despite the item looted may be a minor item, we're not going to tolerate any looting because it's you know, as an orderly society, we've got to be able to deal with these national catastrophes, these weather issues, in an orderly fashion, and that means everybody. Again, going back to the police department, but like with the other city employees, they've been fantastic. Fire department last night cleared dozens and dozens of calls after the storm came through. Those guys in our fire department were working through the night. And then our police department, same thing, working through the night. Long hours, long shifts, but not a single word of complaint.
Mayor Seiler, here we are just, you know, the day after, and you're still assessing the damage. But is there anything at this point that you look back and say, I wish that we had done this, or I wish that we had something in place that would have made our lives easier at this point?
No, I'll tell you, my only real concern right now in terms of what we did is the post-storm curfew, because, you know, we've got cars going out on the road and traffic lights aren't working. Trees are still creating hazards and obstructions. Power lines are still down. Water is still out. I know people are anxious to get back, but the minute people hear the curfew is lifted, it's like a mad rush. You know, it's like the gold rush again. And people want to get back. They want to see their properties. They're anxious. They want to see their family and friends. And having the curfew at 10 a.m. rather than a little later really only gave our crews from sunrise this morning until 10 a.m. to do as much as possible to open up the roads. It still doesn't allow us to, you know, open up all the individual streets in various neighborhoods. You're just going to create a traffic jam with people going down a street and realizing, oh, I can't go further. So
right.
Not having the benefit of the daylight hours to do our work and have our crews do their work puts us in a time crunch and puts our citizens at risk. And that's my biggest concern is, I don't want to see any of our neighbors at risk, especially since, you know, we all got through this storm together, and from a health standpoint, we're in good shape.
That's Jack Seiler, the mayor of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Mayor, good luck with the cleanup, and thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, and have a good day, and to all those first responders out there on 9/11, thank you for your sacrifice and your service.
Let's bring in NPR's Layla Fadel, who has been reporting from Tampa. Layla, before we get to what's happening where you are, what can you tell us about what's happening in Jacksonville, where things seem to be deteriorating today?
Well, there are storm surges, flooding in Jacksonville, Florida. This is a situation that the governor had warned Floridians about. He said that the storm may have passed in your area, but what comes next is possible flooding. And that's what we're seeing in Jacksonville. And that's why he was warning Floridians to try to stay off the streets right now as cities across the state are assessing damage and waiting for post-storm weather deterioration.
What's happening in Tampa, where you are?
Well, Tampa was expected to take a real direct hit, and it's a particularly vulnerable part of the state because of the bay and rising water at the bay. But actually, quite the opposite happened. The storm sucked away a lot of the water in the bay, and the storm didn't really hurt Tampa as much as was expected. And so people are now returning to their homes and finding them pretty much intact. I was with one couple this morning. We walked into an antique shop of crystal and glassware and porcelain teacups, and everything was intact, sitting perfectly in the shelves. Yeah, and they had evacuated completely, prepared for weeks to make sure, prepared for weeks post-storm with canned beans and water, and everything was perfectly fine everywhere they went to check on their properties.
Well, one of the things that surprised some people, and there were images yesterday on TV of Tampa, is that instead of the water coming in as expected, there was a kind of a reverse storm surge there where the water was actually blown out of the bay.
Basically, yes, the storm sucked up water from the bay, the same type of thing that we saw in the Bahamas when the storm was passing through there. And so in one situation that everybody's talking about, tweeting about, posting pictures of is where a manatee couldn't keep up with the water disappearing. And so residents went out there to help the manatee get back into the water. And so that was the big news of Tampa. Of course, there are things like downed trees, power outages, stoplights that aren't working. But overall, Tampa is sighing relief. It's a sigh of relief for a lot of people.
Well, in terms of the power outages, we hear that more than 60% of the state is without power today and that it could take weeks in some areas to restore electricity to everyone. What do we know about that?
That's right. There are power outages for more than there are millions of people without power. In Tampa here, we were seeing people opening up their windows and pulling out their grills to cook outside because they can't do it at home without electricity. And people here are saying they're calling the electric company and they're getting an estimate of anywhere between 3 and 5 days for power to come back on. So cell service also knocked out. But that is the big news today so far, is that people are really sitting in the dark. And as I mentioned before, city to city, everybody is still really assessing the extent of the damage in their city and how the storm affected that city.
And more than 220,000 people across the state were in hundreds of shelters this morning. What do we know about the conditions of those shelters and when people will be able to go home?
People are starting to return home now. You know, a lot of the people that I followed home today were leaving those shelters here in Tampa. In some cases, mayors are urging people not to come home too quick, not to get on the roads too quick. As we saw in Jacksonville, there's that post-surge flooding, but there's also things like stoplights that aren't working or trees that have fallen into areas and blocked roads. So they are asking people not to necessarily get on the roads too quickly. The curfew was lifted here in Tampa, so traffic is running as usual, and you're starting to see people return home. Where I am right now, I met people from Miami, Naples, Jacksonville, all starting to drive back to their city.
That's NPR's Leila Fadel joining us from Tampa, which it sounds like dodged the worst of the storm, but still some effects there. Leila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The fallout continues for the credit monitoring company Equifax today after it announced last week that it had been the victim of a massive data breach. The names, social security numbers, and other personal information of more than 140 million Americans were left vulnerable. So what should consumers do? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. She's in New York. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So let's start with how someone knows that they've been affected, because we know that the emergency website the company set up to help consumers ran into some issues last week.
Yes, that was EquifaxSecurity2017.com. And initially, it seemed like a great idea, because if you went straight onto that website, you'd plug in the last 6 digits of your social, you'd put in your last name, and generally speaking, it would tell you whether or not you were impacted. Unfortunately, a couple of things occurred. First of all, that site is inundated with a lot of volume. And so now all of a sudden, once you enter your information, you can't get confirmation about whether or not you're affected. The people who were immediately pushed into the protection service called Trusted ID, that came under scrutiny for a couple of reasons. One is it didn't seem like that was very fair to just give you 1 year of service for free. And then that there was this waiver of rights for the cybersecurity incident, which they then rescinded. Long story short is that EquifaxSecurity2017.com may not be your best bet to get the ball rolling on protecting your identity.
Well, it also sounds kind of like a fake website with that.
I know, doesn't it?
Yeah, with that address. So what should people do if they think that they've been affected by this?
You know, no, I would just presume that you are affected. I mean, 55% of adults over the age of 18 are affected. And if you think about that, this is just the first round. We've seen in other security breaches where later on it becomes very clear that more people are involved than initially thought. So what I would do, first of all, is you can contact not just Equifax. You can go to one of the other credit companies, Experian or TransUnion. Put a free fraud alert on your credit report. If you notify one, that one must then notify the other two. That's going to give you a 90-day protection. You can renew it, but it just also entitles you to a free credit report from each of the three companies. This is a good way to sort of see if any shenanigans have taken place up until this point.
Is it worth it to go through this trouble? I mean, what are the possible consequences if you don't?
I think it is worth it. Look, I did it this weekend, and I actually also went one step beyond this. I put a credit freeze on my credit file. You know, what this does is it stops all access to your credit report. Now, first of all, that's a pain in the neck because that means you're freezing it for yourself as well. And you've got to do it with each of these three companies. Total pain in the butt. It took me a good hour and a half. I had a lot of coffee. That was worth it. But you know what? It's also important to remember that if you are trying to apply for credit, a student loan, maybe a car loan, you've got to then unfreeze your credit at all three of these companies. Then get your credit, then put the freeze back on. I think it's worth it because you know what? When I speak to security experts, they say this information is going to live well beyond the next year. So nothing could happen for a year. 2 years from now, all that data is out there. So you might as well be safer than sorry.
That's Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. I wish there was some way we could just avoid getting into this trouble in the beginning, but I don't think that doesn't sound like it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Jill,
yep.
Jill, thank you.
Take care.
It sounds like Irma's legacy in Florida will be the extent of her reach as opposed to her punch, although damage in parts of the state is still unknown. Let's go to Fort Myers on the West Coast. Mayor Randall Henderson, how did you fare?
Right now, the assessment is that we have isolated serious flooding across Fort Myers and on the perimeter. We are addressing that as best we can. We have downed trees, downed power lines. We have energy companies mobilizing and ready to dispatch. We have some electricity around homes, and citizens are easing back into their homes, and they can do so safely.
Okay, well, that's good. Now, listen, Fort Myers there, often called the gateway to southwest Florida, you're about 40 miles north of Naples, and heavily dependent on tourism. How was that a factor, you know, as you tried to shelter everybody?
Well, some tourists were able to leave, and for that good judgment, we thank them and credit them. They're welcome here anytime, but this was an urgent situation. Others were provided for through a number of shelters around the region, including City of Fort Myers and Lee County, and I'm told we're safely held up in those places. We are easing back now into homes and other places and trying to do that as safely as possible.
Everybody's just assessing things, but it feels as if, you know, nobody, we saw the videos of what the winds were like at the height of the storm in Fort Myers there. I'm sure you wouldn't want anybody out on the streets when that was happening.
Right.
They would not have survived. But Are you worried that because the storm did not unleash as much as it could have, that people will not take it seriously the next time?
My expectation is in future events like this, they will continue to take it serious. We have an intense focus on preservation of life, safety, and welfare, and I think we did pretty good on that, if not great. And nothing about this is convenient. The preservation of life is the chief focus.
Mayor Henderson there in Fort Myers, Florida. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's go south to Naples. Ed Laudiste is vice principal at North Naples Middle School, which became a shelter that he helped run. Ed, Naples, battered but not broken?
It's amazing that I have not been able to leave yet. I don't even know what my house looks like and whatnot, but the preliminary reports I'm getting from our Bureau of Emergency Management is that we've been more fortunate than we could ever expect. I also can't say enough about some of the residents. We did house people from the community. Overall, Collier County housed a little over 15,000 people, and we had about 600 here at this organization. And at the end, when our power went out and our generator went out, guy came up to me, "Mister, I got a generator. You want me to plug in some fans?" So we did the best we could to keep people cool and all that, but it was a real example of different levels and echelons of our community coming together and just getting through.
Look, I'm just wondering about the fear here, because you all watched Harvey.
Right.
Irma took forever, and
yes,
we knew she was going to be a monster storm. What was sort of the emotional temperature of the room?
I got to tell you, it was really pretty calm. We did dinners and stuff in an orderly fashion. We explained what to expect, you know, and at some point the PA system would be down. At that point, the National Guard was assisting us with making sure we had communications, because we have a multiple building facility here, so they weren't just in one location. So at one point, you know, you can't go outside. So thanks to the National Guard and a lot of other people, we were able to communicate not only beforehand, but at times, because we're a pet-friendly place, is one of the things we did during the eye was allow people to kind of get out for a few minutes with the dogs, you know, stretch their legs and stuff like that. But fortunately, we were able to clear out the shelter. People are now checking their houses and where they live, and we do have a couple interesting people here. We had a World War II vet, and we got him back home. We have a family from Venezuela that was here on vacation, and the hotel shut down. They wound up here. We're working to try to get them their next stop for their vacation is St. Petersburg. So we're trying to get them a hotel so they can get situated on the road up that way.
Well, I'm not sure if you know, but, you know, there's flooding up north. Jacksonville saw record-setting flooding today from Irma.
Okay. I don't have any intel on anything on account of the fact I've lost all forms of communication. As a matter of fact, this is the first phone call that has gone through.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like it's going to be the biggest challenge, feeling your way.
Right. Well, you know, people are out of harm's way. You can replace stuff. You can't replace people.
Hey, Ed, how did this happen? You're an assistant principal. You're sounding like a Red Cross official. I mean, how did you suddenly get anointed?
You know, I go all the way back to Boy Scouts, be prepared to, you know, just be good to people, and you wind up landing on your feet.
Listen, Ed, I'm going to let you go since your phone just started working again, and let you talk to family and stuff. That's Ed Laudice, a history teacher, assistant principal at North Naples Middle School, which became a shelter last night. Ed, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, first responders from around the country are heading to Florida to help with the recovery efforts. And despite the intense wildfire season in California, that state is sending a search and rescue team to help out in the aftermath of Irma. More than 500 California first responders also went to Southeast Texas to assist the Hurricane Harvey efforts. Reporter Alex Emsley of member station KQED went out with a rescue crew.
I'm with three firefighters, wading through Tamarind Woods, a neighborhood of ranch homes an hour south of Houston. A few residents are sloshing back and forth, and one woman is using garbage bags as waterproof pants. This is one of the places that seemed okay after Harvey hit, at first, but then reservoirs upstream started overflowing.
It wasn't flooded. They were told they'd come back, and then it started to rise again, so they called us out to double check, make sure everybody was out, and do a secondary search.
Captain Scott Lewis is a Sacramento firefighter. But out here, he leads a team of swift water rescuers for FEMA. The water is up around our thighs on the road, but rises to chest deep if you step off the shoulder. Lewis warns me to stay in the middle. Try to follow the yellow line, barely visible through the murky water. We come up to a pickup truck. Two men are talking through the window with the driver, Jeff Satsky. He's out on patrol.
We're going to change the name of the neighborhood from Tamarind Woods to the river runs through it.
He is the neighborhood
watchdog.
He was here before the water started coming up and made damn sure nobody was bothering.
Pat Frazier stops for a rest, puts a hand on the truck for support. I ask him how bad his house is.
Oh, it's okay. I can't use an electric blanket, but
it's got about 20 inches of water in there.
Yeah, it came up about 4 days ago.
This is the overflow from the Brazos.
Jim Lester has spent the last week doing what he can for people like Frazier. He lives an hour away, and his house is fine.
Why are you going out to help people?
Because they need help. I don't know. They just need help. If I was in that shape, I'd want somebody to come help me, so I'm doing what I want people to do for me.
Harvey killed at least 70 people and drove more than 50,000 from their homes. Pat Frazier has seen this kind of destruction before, but never in quite this way.
I'm a retired insurance adjuster, worked 1,000 flood claims after the water's gone, and to be a victim of one and to be inside that house when your clothes are floating in front of you and everything else is going on is just incredible.
Frazier is surprised when he learns the firefighters are from 2,000 miles away.
You guys are here from Sacramento, California? I can't even say enough how good it makes me feel.
the floodwaters seem to have washed away any notion of rivalry between Texas and California, the quintessential red and blue states.
The truth of the matter is, you guys are here. We're y'all, y'all are us. We're Americans. Yeah. Don't give me a crying now.
It's our pleasure, sir, our okay? Friend.
Thank you very much.
California sent more than 500 first responders to Texas. Captain Scott Lewis from Sacramento says it's not easy work, but you learn to cope.
We deal with life and death and birth and cancer. We deal with that all the time. I mean, when someone calls 911, they don't want a hug necessarily. They want your action.
Lewis and the rest of California Task Force 7 are on the road back to Sacramento. Some of them may soon head out again to fight the wildfires burning across the state. I'm Alex Emsley.
We will continue to follow events in Florida, but now we want to take a short musical respite ahead of a great event.
We could change the whole story of love. Same old play, I'm getting tired of. No more acting these predictable roles. Just a sleeping, unconditional love.
That's Unconditional Love from Grammy-winning jazz musician Esperanza Spalding's 2016 album Emily's D Plus Evolution. And you can watch her next album, Be Born, live on Facebook. Tomorrow, starting at 9 a.m. Pacific time, Esperanza Spalding aims to spend 77 hours straight writing and recording 10 songs for her new album, Exposure, spontaneously. She joins us now. And Esperanza, you're going to be teaching students at Harvard this spring, and you tell new players that music should be about responding to what's happening in the moment, you know, even if it's a mistake. Respond to that.
Yeah, and it isn't just response to self. I mean, it's response to everything that's coming into your orbit, you know. I'm a part of the orbit of the people I'm with, too. So it's also about how my spontaneous engagement supports their exploration.
And you've also been very frank. You have said out loud, this is also a way of recording where a label can't interfere because you're doing it and it's done.
My poor label. Interfere is sort of exaggerated because I've never felt like they interfered with my mission. It's just the motive of investing in a project is to earn a great return on your investment. So there are a lot of questions and conversations that revolve around, okay, how are we going to sell it? Like, what's the angle? What's the distribution? Which are all fine questions if you're a business person. But if you're an artist and your mission is to tap into your voice and what it is that you've come here to share, I find it really debilitating. What's really cool about this is certain questions just can't be answered, so they can't really be asked. So instead of saying, we're going for the urban audience or the jazz audience or whatever, we're just saying we're looking for people who are interested in supporting a creative exploration, and whatever comes out of it will be the album.
And you've been practicing. Now, how do you do that? Because I would assume that as soon as you start practicing writing something quickly and simply and responding to what you're doing in the moment, then you've written something, and then you're going to think about it more and think about, well, maybe I should, am I going to bring that into this recording process? And then already it's different. So how do you practice?
Well, it's like practicing for a game. No matter how well rehearsed your plays are, you know full well that when you get onto the field, anything can happen. So you practice the plays to be ready to move in similar kinds of combinations, right? Mm. The reason that we practice is to get used to kind of ways that things tend to go. And then we hope that there's kind of a magical byproduct of that, mm-hmm. which is preparation for the unexpected. Mm.
I don't suppose you have a tune that's maybe running through your head right now that could give us an example of practice?
I can. I was just thinking about my dear friend Bettina Chin, who just lost her mother. And I was thinking, what would a loving, not too triggery allegory be? I wasn't really working on a song, but I was trying to work out a lyric scheme. The idea of like a water channel that has opened up dry earth. So it's made like a stream bed where there used to be none.
Can we hear a little?
I don't know if there's anything there yet. I guess we'll find out. Something like, where it's dry. Where, don't let those tears waste and cry. Where it was dry. Now there's a new space coming through. Don't you worry, it's coming back to you.
Ooh.
Or something. And now in the studio, through the course of the next hour or so, I would, you know, develop probably that kind of refine that verse a little bit and develop it further and figure out what the hell I'm actually trying to say.
Wow.
And then, et cetera.
For 77 continuous hours, how are you feeling going into it?
I feel very scared, wondering a little bit why the hell I'm doing this. And because the project rests on real live exposure with a real live audience, the only way to find out if it's worth doing is to try it. I know that it's good that I feel scared, but some little part in the back of my mind is like, I'm just going to make a total fool of myself in front of everybody. And hopefully it'll at least be entertaining.
Jazz musician Esperanza Spalding. Her Facebook Live recording of her new album, Exposure, begins tomorrow at 9 a.m. Pacific time. For more, go to hereandnow.org. Esperanza, we'll be watching.
Okay, deal. Thank you.
Jeremy, there's no way in heck that I would ever let everybody see every little detail that goes into my work. It's going to be something. Log on to hereandnow.org to figure out how to listen and watch tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.